Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that sound. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that sound. Wiggling.
Yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West West, y'all.
All right. Here we go with episode 584, live and direct of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric, the Media Assassin. And this show is sponsored by Cocaine Buddy Boy Entertainment, Screwball Radio, which you catch every Saturday night, Da Vinci Clothing. And we on live, robbing direct. Got my host T-Max with the facts in the building.
What it do. Another marvelous Monday on that OTC frequency. Shout out to our co-host from Spirit, Elada Sandman, Lady Chinchilla, and, of course, DJ Sincere of Dirty Basement Radio up in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, this tonight is one of the most historically consequential and unbelievable achievements that we have ever achieved on Off the Cuff Radio, because our guest, his achievements are beyond astounding, amazing, and incredible. This man, for what he has done for the better part of 35 years in not only hip-hop culture, but music culture in general, has contributed so much with his tireless effort, his tremendous passion for any project that he has put his heart and soul into. It's almost unfathomable how much this man means to the culture, because he is instrumental. T himself credits this man for giving hip-hop its notoriety and its flowers of appreciation before the culture really took off. You know this man primarily for his masterwork of a documentary in 1997 with The Rhyme and Reason, which he initially started in 1994. While that is one of his most known, it doesn't stop there. This man also did Tupac's Thug Angel, Notorious Big's Bigger Than Life. He did Rhyme and Punishment, and too many others that we can name in this intro. And for the aforementioned Rhyme and Reason, it was also Academy nominated by the Oscars. Yes, it was and next week he's going to be having it shown at the Academy Museum. Rolling Stone calls it one of the greatest documentaries ever committed to a culture ever. And we, right now at Off the Cuff Radio, are so proud, we are so privileged, we are so honored to have this man in his excellence, his extraordinary achievements and amazing ability talk with us about his illustrious and storied career. He is the head of Rugged Entertainment. Shout out. Oh, we can't forget the Rhyme and Reason book is out on Real Art Press as well. So go cop that. Shout out to Kathy Bevan as well for helping us to put this on. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, Mr. Peter Spirer, welcome to Off the Cuff Radio.
Hey guys, how you doing?
How you doing?
Great, man. Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm pleased to be here, and you know, let's chop it up.
Absolutely, Peter. Your story is extraordinary. Let's get right into it. How did you start?
Well, you know, I worked on music videos back in the day. I worked at MTV. I was doing that kind of work. And I think, you know, as it relates to hip-hop, like the first hip-hop show I saw, I think was the very first show Public Enemy ever played, which was at Nassau Community College. They opened up for the Beastie Boys, who I had gone to see. And when I went to the show, I was blown away by the charisma, by the energy of the show. And it got me really thinking about hip-hop, you know, because I was actually, you know, kind of a rock kid and played rock music, played guitar. And I really recognized this new musical dynamic that I really wanted to know more about. Ended up working on a lot of music videos, and I had previously done a movie that I got nominated for an Academy Award about a photographer. So I was looking for my next project, and I thought, you know, there hadn't really been anything that, in my opinion, documented the culture of hip-hop. At the time, music videos were more about showing a kind of a lifestyle that was kind of a fantasy, you know what I mean? And then it was condemned in the mainstream media, and I thought, gosh, you know, I'll make something. You know, what always attracted me to music videos was what was happening behind the scenes, you know, where people are hanging out, you know, the relationship between, you know, family and friends, all that stuff made a lot more sense to me about the culture than their actual videos did. So, you know, I embarked on a 3-year odyssey to film this stuff, and, you know, was hoping to get into a couple of movie theaters. I had no clue Miramax would end up buying the movie. And, you know, we'd have a gold soundtrack. So it was, a lot of good, a lot of bad. I mean, I had a lot of issues with Miramax, and working with them was very difficult. But in the end, I'm very proud of the movie, how the movie came out, you know. And I was fortunate that along the way, while making the movie, I pulled out an old Rolleiflex camera, which shoots with a big size negative, and I took all these amazing photographs. And you know, when you're doing it at the time, and you know, I was a lot younger then, you know, sometimes I brought the camera, sometimes I didn't, but thankfully I brought it more than I did, and you know, got some great photographs, which are now part of a book called The Book of Rhyme and Reason, which is out now. You can get it everywhere.
Man, Peter, I mean, I was trying to get everything because I didn't want to take up too much of the time for the show in terms of the intro, and there's still shit I left out. I mean, dude, you're a writer, director, producer. I mean, you've been responsible for over 20 feature films. I mean, your first, you know, Oscar nomination was for Blood Ties, you know, the life and work of Sally Mann in 1993. I mean, dude, I mean, your career is amazing.
Yeah, I've been, you know, I've been fortunate, man. You know, I sometimes I was in the right place at the right time, you know, and particularly with hip hop, you know. I mean, to me, I was at the golden age, you know, particularly with Rhyme and Reason, you know. I mean, you know, there's still great artists today and everything else, but back then, when the culture was so unique, when there was so much diversity, when you had, you know, Heavy D and the Boys, and you had Biz Markie, mm-hmm. and you had, you know, EPMD. People forget how big EPMD were, you know?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, the Hit Squad, you know, I mean, you know, all that stuff was so really cool and big, but still, you know, it wasn't in the mainstream like it is today, you know? It was still, you know, kind of getting there. And, you know, I was there at the right time, you know?
Yeah. When you think about it during that time, Peter, hip-hop, because Ice-T, as we said earlier, Ice-T gives you so much love and respect. Shout out to Uncle Ice for supporting Off the Cuff Radio as well. You know, him and the whole team. Hip-hop by the time you had started on your journey in 1994 with what would become Rhyme and Reason, like you said, there had already been historical figures. They had already began their march in it. Queen Latifah, of course, like you said, Heavy D, EPMD, KRS-One, Public Enemy. We were seeing Nas. A young Nas, a young Jay-Z, a young B.I.G., Main Source, Ice-T was still in the midst of, you know, was about 8 years in from his career when he started. So we're seeing this blossoming forest of freshness that is still nascent, but we're still seeing an energy of raw passion and unabashed narration of not only hip-hop life, but street life. This is especially in the early 1990s when we saw gangster rap, you know, with what N.W.A. eventually made popular. We have to keep it in historical context, though. They were not the first gangster rappers. Schoolie D was, and then Ice-T would come later, and then N.W.A. were the ones who really kicked that door down.
Sure.
But it would all come into the 90s of Dr. Dre, Snoop, Ice Cube, Compton's Most Wanted, King T, Naughty by Nature, oh my God, Boss. For those who remember that album, Born Gangsters with her and D. I mean, Above the Rim soundtrack, Menace to Society soundtrack, Boys in the Hood, Fresh, South Central soundtrack. I mean, God, I mean, this was just, did you understand the significance of what you were going to do? Because this took you 3 years, and you did roughly 80 to 100 interviews and shot. How many hours did you shoot for that footage of the documentary?
You know, I never really counted up the hours, but you're right. It's about 80 artists that we filmed. The thing was, you know, we shot in film. So that was the other thing. We didn't have a studio behind us, or even a record company at the time behind us. We were, you know, hand to mouth, you know. I mean, and we probably shot more film stock than any movie ever made. If you see Rhyme and Reason, there's all kinds of different looks and everything. And that wasn't an aesthetic, you know, choice. That was out of pure necessity because, you know, I worked for other production companies, and I would go to them and I was like, hey, do you have any film that's left over from a video shoot? You know, I was getting recans and, you know, God knows. I mean, it's unbelievable we did what we did. So our resources were limited, but we had to, like hip-hop, you know, like, you know, using a turntable as an instrument. I mean, we had to be very resourceful with the limited budget that we had. And we knew we wanted to shoot the film in film. Well, actually, in 94, there really wasn't a choice. I mean, you know, video was so archaic back then. It was still pretty, you know, or you know, you'd have to have huge cameras and we made the right choice. We made the right choice in film thing.
Thinking about it with the art of the video back then, Peter, because you had already done work on, you know, working for MTV. MTV for us growing up was, and later, of course, BET when they would have Rap City. But BET and Rap and MTV were obviously, you know, the big boys on the block. And then, of course, Video Music Box would come in. But MTV for a few years was the standard. Myself growing up in Virginia, especially, you know, being a hard rock, heavy metal fan as well. You know, of course, the days of Saxon, Slayer, Megadeth, Anthrax, Exodus, Testament, Overkill, Violent, Death Angel, Suicidal Tendencies. I mean, I was a fan of all these bands, Living Color, Eric Gill's band. I mean, from your experience working at MTV, what was it like in terms of working at it from the corporate side and then ultimately from the video side in terms of how you put everything together for that?
Well, yeah, and I didn't answer your previous question, which I wanted to, which you asked if I recognized the significance of what I was doing. And honestly, I would have probably, you know, looking back at it, probably I would say no. Look, I knew the artists were great. I knew there was a lot of talent. Whether what we made anybody would even care about, I had no idea. Like, I had no idea what the reception of the film would be, whether would people would care, whether they would want to see the artists the way I was showing them, which was kind of in a realistic, you know, setting. You know, I mean, I didn't, you know, I was sort of, it was like pulling the curtain back, you know, and seeing how people really live and deal with stuff and all those kinds of things. And I, you know, fortunately I was, you know, had good instincts and people did want to see this stuff. You know, I'll tell you one time, I mean, this is getting off topic a little bit, but
no, go ahead.
I delivered a lot of films to a company called Image Entertainment. I did The Beef and, you know, a bunch of other things with those guys, you know, Tupac, Doug Jennings, and everything else. And the owner of the company one time came over and said to me, he goes, "Man, you know what I really love about you? You give me what's going to be popular 2 years from now. I get people giving me stuff that's already popular and it's already too late. Because the time I get it, I got to put it out. It's going to take a year and a half. And that wave is already over. You're always ahead of the curve." You know, I mean, I've always had the ability to look into a, you know, a crystal ball and see the future. I mean, I think that's one of the, you know, one of the things I have, you know, which allowed me to do some of the things I've done. You know, like even my first film, I knew the censorship issue was going to be a big deal. And, you know, there was a lot of controversy going on. And, you know, I jumped into it and did this film about this woman who's being censored, and it kind of caught on in the art world. You know, next thing was a hip-hop. I said, you know, there's some really cool hip-hop films out there, but there aren't any that lets the artists tell their story. And that's what I really wanted to do, you know. And, you know.
And I think that's why.
That's the thing that films, you know, when they came in the different range, like you got it to also, not just gangster rap, but also the fifth elements to it. And I think KRS on there, and West Development, I think,
was up there too, so you had a great range.
Yeah, yeah. I'm having trouble hearing you a little bit, but I heard something about like having a great range. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a great range.
Oh, range. Yeah. I think, like, you look, you know, we after I made Rhyme and Reason, fortunately, I hooked up with TD3, who's Quincy Jones' son and a very talented producer, you know, composer, and they love Rhyme and Reason, and they wanted me to work on a number of projects, and you know, we had a great partnership together, and then that turned out, and you know, I did a few other films after that in the hip hop culture, but you know, it's been very rewarding, man. You know, I'm thrilled to death about the Academy thing coming up, which, you know, is a real honor to have that, you know, book and the film recognized. They as part of the 50-year anniversary of hip hop, you know, they want to play it. And the film came out 25 years ago, so it's like perfect timing.
Man, I mean, we got plenty of time, so let's, you know, because we still got so much history to cover, but you brought that up, so let's go ahead and get into that. How did
Sure.
the Academy decide at that particular moment, did they come to that, that obviously the film that you created with this, when we look at it from, it needs to be in the Library of Congress for aesthetically or culturally important. Because, dude, I mean, you got Wu-Tang when they were still young in their career. You got Ice-T, you got Lauryn Hill, you got The Far Side, Curtis Blow. I mean, you literally have Lauryn Hill. You got legends in there who have already cemented their legacy, and then the ones who are beginning to come in the next wave. Like you said, the candidness, the elements of just everyday life with them, just seeing how their day-to-day is, I think was – we've still never seen a film like that to just show the artists as regular people.
One funny thing about – I mean, I don't know if it's funny, but, you know, I thought I was finished with the film about a year into it. A year and a half into it, and I had filmed Nas, I filmed Wu-Tang, I think I filmed Redman, Eric Sermon, you know, a few other people, and then I went out to L.A. Actually, I went out to L.A. and showed some people what I had, and they got really upset, and they were like, "Hey, man, we don't have hip hop in L.A." You know, and I was like, "Oh my God." Because I was from New York at the time and I was living there, it was really heavy New York artists. So I realized, oh my God, I can't have a film just about East Coast artists. And that's when I spent another year and a half developing relationships. The other thing, like, I don't know if I told you this, but when I made Rhyme and Reason, thankfully I was very naive about, you know, how to do this. And if I had done it in a real corporate sense or, you know, professional way, I would have contacted people's managers and agents and all that stuff, and I'd still be working on the film. What I did
Perfect
instead
segue.
Was...
Go ahead.
What I did instead was, if I interviewed Redman, I'd say, "Hey, if you like the way the interview went, can you recommend just one person? Just connect me with one other artist that you know, he would connect me with Method Man. Or, you know, Eric Sermon would connect me with this one." You know, whatever it was, it was artist by artist until I got to L.A. And then at that point, you know, some of the record companies saw what I was doing and helped out a little bit. But I didn't mean to go around agents and around managers, but for me, getting the film done on what I was looking to do, that's the approach I took. I don't know if you could do that today, you know. But at the time, artists wanted to tell their stories. They were excited about being in a film and doing Rhyme and Reason.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue because we were about to ask you, Peter, about what it was like to interact with all these artists. Because, I mean, you got Dr. Dre. I mean, you got all these. You got MC8 in this. I mean, it's like these are heavy
Spice
hitters
one.
At the time. Spice One. I mean, you got heavy hitters in this. And it's like, you know, me and my brother, we always talk. We've done so many shows with so many people. We talk about the videos. We talk about what it was like during that time. About how music videos were shot and everything, about how a cameo, about how albums were recorded. When there were cameos, it felt so organic. You know, it wasn't like you felt like there was a whole bunch of business having to be. It's just like, yo, they call them up, be like, you want to do it? Okay, here's how much, and this is what it is. And it's like with Rhyme and Reason, it's just so organic to see all these people. It's an all-star of where the show. Out to Russell Simmons and Def Jam for what they did with it. The show was more documentary, was more of a chronicle of touring, where Rhyme and Reason was more the chronicles about beats, rhymes, and life. Shout to Tribe Called Quest, rest in peace, Fight Doll. You know, so you were able to really connect with these people in a real way. And I think that's what makes this film so extraordinary. What was it like? How did that come about that the Academy decided that they were going to screen your film when you actually had that sit-down talk with them?
Well, what happened was when the book, you know, the book is being released now, and apparently, like, the top art books are part of the catalog that go out to museums and libraries and that kind of thing. And when the Academy saw it, they were like, oh, wow, you know, a book of Rhyme and Reason. And, hey, you know, can we get Peter to do a book signing? And, hey, is there a film print? They responded right away. I mean, they were very, very positive about it and recognized, you know, that there was an opportunity. They had wanted to do something about the 50th year anniversary, and they thought that this would be a great way to kick that off. You know, I think they're going to try to get other films for the next year or so. But I do know, I don't know what they're thinking of, but, you know, they definitely reached out to me and, you know, it just seemed to all be like perfect. You know, the book, the 50th year, the 25th anniversary of the film, you know, they got it. You know, they got it.
Man, I mean, in terms of
I'm gonna ask you too. When you get these artists, what was your strategy on making them open up? Because you had them open up, telling a lot of their personal history that they probably would be really guarded on. Like, what was your strategy on getting them to open up?
You know, that's a good question, and I've always had the ability to make people at ease. Like, you know, sometimes people tell me too much. You know what I mean? I've had that happen. I tell you what, on the Beef Series, you know, there were a couple times, I don't want to mention names, but people call me up and go, hey, you know what I talked about in that interview? You know, it'd be better if you didn't use that, you know? And you know, I respect that, you know? I feel like I love the culture. I love the people in it, you know, and I want to, but I'm a journalist at the same time, you know. I mean, I'm here to tell a story. I'm here to tell people, you know, what the truth is from my perspective. And I think people recognize, like, where I was coming from. The artists that I had previously shot, who probably spoke highly about what I was doing. And, you know, they seemed behind it, you know. There really wasn't a document before Rhyme and Reason of the culture the way I had envisioned doing. So, you know, the artists were, for the most part, you know, like, you know, you get put through tests, man, you know. I mean, look. You know, particularly, I really didn't know, dude, you know, it'd be, you know, maybe you know, like Puffy waiting in his office for 3.5 hours. You know what I mean? But,
right,
you know, you
right.
hang around and you're patient enough, you know, you get in there and you get a great interview, you know, or, you know, following Big around for a couple of days until he was ready to do the interview, you know. So there, you know, sometimes there was that warming up period.
Then
sometimes I have to, you know, like, look, it can be a real quick red light, green light, man, you know. And you want to make sure, you know, you get what you need when you do the interview. In all my years, I've never had, the only bad experience I ever had was with BMS, you know. And, you know, I totally appreciate him as an artist. As someone who I tried to get to interview, I think I waited in the hotel room for 7 days. And his publicist, who was such a great guy, he kept apologizing about it. When I finally got to interview him, he only would answer a few questions and very vaguely. I really didn't have anything. However, I saw him later on with Trex, and I know Trex a little bit. So I said, hey, Trex, can you, you know, help me out? I'm trying to do this thing with DMS. And he, you know, he brought it. He said, come over here, man, you know. And they did it together, and that was good. But, you know, if Trex wasn't there, it would have been the same kind of red light situation. But, you know, but it just depends sometimes the situation you're in, you know. You know, and you got to recognize sometimes artists are going through things, you know.
I
don't take anything personally, man. Like when I'm trying to do stuff, I you know, I've got a job to do and try to look at it as, hey, what will people find interesting? What, you know, how can I connect? You know, how, you know, and sometimes you have to do that very quickly.
That's true. We, you know, rest in peace to X. And, you know, we love X. And we know X had his issues. And it was always, it was not always an easy road for him. You know,
sure.
In terms of the things he dealt with in life. We don't need to rehash it on the show. You know what I'm saying? It's the documented, you know, if you want to go online and look it up. When you think about how the scene is today, Peter, I mean, to see guys like Tupac, to see guys like Biggie and Puff before they really became who they were. Pac was already, you know, sadly we lost him in 96. You know, when you drop this in 97, you know, unfortunately Biggie, you know, was taken from us. But when we look at what was happening, you know, Bad Boy Records had started in earnest in 1993 and pretty much with Puffy's guidance by 1998, you know, I mean, they were, you know, they was up. I mean, what is it like to see these people and look back and be like, yo, I got these people. You know, I mean, you got a Young Exhibit rapping in it. You know, you got Wu-Tang in this before, you know, and, you know, they're just, that 97 is when they dropped their second album. You know, Exhibit is a year after dropping his first album and 3 years after he makes his debut on King T's, you know, For Life album. So you are in the midst of all this history here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I got a great story about it because when we did Wu-Tang, it was like the coldest day in February, man. It was like unbelievable. And, you know, the movie starts with Wu-Tang Clan. And you got Method Man spitting amazing freestyles. It's fantastic. And then after that, you know, well, what happened was, so 3 years later, now we're finishing the film, and we invite Method Man and RZA into the studio to take a look at what we're doing. You know, they were one of the first ones that saw the completed film. I think Ice was there. I think, well, no, not the same day, but We had RZA and we had Method Man in our editing suite. You know, we turned down the lights, we turned it on, you know, and I have no idea how they're going to react to it. You know what I mean? And it comes on, and dude, you see them, and they start going, oh, God, man, can you believe this? Oh, no, oh, God, I, you know, they're like, they're like really upset. And we're freaking out. I'm freaking out. I go, oh my God, they hate it. They hate it. And then they say, we'll never be this cool again. We'll never be this real again. You know, they had already eclipsed what they had, what they were. You know, they were like, we'll never be this hungry again. I mean, they saw, it was like they were looking at different people.
Right, right.
And you know what I mean?
You gotta, and you got to think about it. This month, 30 years ago, the album dropped, and then the documentary in 93, the album dropped in 93, and 4 years later, they're looking back like, wow.
Yeah, they were like, they looked, they were like, oh my God, we've gotten too big. You know, we're like, we're too, you know, I mean, at first, but I didn't know at first. Like, I thought they were, like, upset at us, or how we filmed them or something. You know what I mean? I didn't know that, you know. So, but, yeah, it's amazing in those 3 years or 4 years, like, from them, you know, from filming them to, you know, all the, you know, things that they did, and now they're making movies and doing all, you know, soundtracks and all this stuff. And,
it was crazy. We also, too,
you know, unfortunately, the week the film came out was the same week Biggie was killed.
Ooh.
So our film dropped, and 2 days later, Big was shot.
Oh, man.
And, yeah.
I mean, that's crazy. And I mean, but the thing is, though, but the bright side of it is that you all are part of his history, you know, in terms of the video.
Yeah.
You got Big in terms of when, you know, he was right, you know, his first album, Ready to Die, dropped, I believe, September 13th, 1994. And you figure that, you know, within that time frame, you know, with that, because of course we watched the scene with him in the jeans and the Coogee sweater. So this is probably around what, 95, 96. So Big is already a rap phenomenon right then. I mean, Big is up, like he's heavy.
Yeah, Big had money then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was showing off his flat.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was one of my favorite things, like, you know, being at his place. But I remember
mm-hmm.
was having to get there really early in the morning. I don't know whether he was flying out or something, or he had a show, or I don't know what was going on, but I remember getting there like around 8 in the morning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's sitting on this couch and there were these plaques to the side. I said, hey, man, can you open these plaques up? It looked like he had just gotten them. And he was like, yeah. You know, I mean, the one thing I loved about Big was I really felt that he really appreciated his success and how far he'd come and being able to provide for his family and all that kind of stuff, man. I mean, he loved life. He that guy, I was profoundly saddened when he passed away because he was such a, you know, he had such a life force about him.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's unbelievable he's gone. I him and Tupac. I mean, Tupac too. But Tupac, on the other hand, if someone said Tupac, I wouldn't be as shocked. You know, Biggie dying, that was a shock. That was a shock.
Because every day, every week you were hearing Tupac in some stuff, man. Like, you were hearing him getting fights, shootouts, and beats and stuff. It was only a matter of time before, you know, somebody tried to pull that card. But for Big, you know, Big, from the way the perception was, Big stayed out of the way.
Exactly. I mean, Big... You know, Tupac, all of a sudden he's racing against time. You know, like he knew he didn't have a lot of time. He was just trying to do so much. Big, on the other hand, I felt like he was in a place in his life where he was really enjoying everything that was happening, you know, really, really appreciating it, you know. I mean, they were two completely different artists, yet, you know, to me, they're equals in terms of their charisma, their, you know, the stuff that they did, you know. I mean, they're different, but the same. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, they both we get it exactly. They both epitomize an essence of, you know, that, you know, the daily struggle of what black men deal with, you know, even after celebrity. I think one with Big, I think Big was just better. I think his temperament was more equipped to handle it. Like King said, Big was, you never really heard of, well, you know, we're young, you know, we were young back then. But, you know, we never really heard any stories about Big getting into it with people like that. Pac, who we love dearly. You know, we always heard about, you know, Pac doing some shit. Pac got in a shootout. Pac was fighting with somebody. You know, it's like, we're like, God damn. We're like, dude is all, I mean.
But when we got to also keep in mind how young they were.
I mean,
it's unbelievable. Like, you know, a few more years of maturity, things could have, you know, would have changed. I think Pac would have went on to become, you know, a political force, you know? I mean, he was, but who knows? I mean, you know, I wouldn't count him out of anything.
Man, when you think about it, because you figure Pac was 25 when he was killed, and I think Big was 24 when he was killed. So you're thinking Pac's first album, Tupacalypse Now, was released, I believe, if I got it right. And you know, I want to say it was November 19th, 1991, I believe, when Tupacalypse Now was first released. It was definitely November 1991. So you figure Pac was like, what, 19, 20 years old when he dropped his first album. 2021, you know, so this is, and it's, I mean, that, because this is the issue I have with some people who say they're fans of Pop when they only think of, when they only name their songs is, you know, Dear Mama and, you know, How Do You Want It? And I'm like, no, y'all got to go back to the first album to really get it, because to me, the first album was just unbelievable. I first heard it. You know, but also, too, you know, with Big, you know, listening to him, you know, on the Dolly My Baby remix with Supercat, you know, the Bad Boy remix. And I mean, you know, Big's first, you know, verse of the, I love it when you call me Big Pop, fuck the show, stop, fuck the rap, drop, fuck. I'm like, yo, we're like, yo, who is this dude? You know?
Yeah,
man?
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
You know, I mean, we were witnessing two of the greatest ever to do it, and we did not know that we were not going to have them for that long, which makes it all the more bittersweet. But to see the excitement of what they brought, the verve, the energy, the passion, the creativity, you know, that young enthusiasm. When you look at it, Pete, from what the scene was back in the 90s when you started doing this, and you've been a lifelong music connoisseur, we have to get more into that. But when you look at hip-hop culture back then, what do you see different now than what it was back in the 90s?
You know, I mean, for me, you know, it's tough for me, man. I mean, I still live in the 90s and the early 2000s, you know. I think the lack of diversity, you know, probably is the thing that I feel is the biggest issue to me. You know, I mean, you know, look, I come from there where biting was a crime, you know. And my son is a total hip-hop, you know, head. You know, you know, he'll totally disagree with me. But, you know, I still feel like the older art. I mean, I love that time period. I love the style of music, the style of the diversity of the rhyme skills, all that stuff. So, you know, I mean, there are some great artists today, but, you know, I think when I turn on my radio, I'm probably listening to those older songs.
We can't do this show without shouting our buddy out in California, who one of our sponsored supporters from California Love Podcast, Kenya Ware, who is in Rhyme and Reason as well. Because definitely she's about the old school as well. Kenya sends her regards. She loves everything that you all did with it.
Oh yeah.
You know, when you look at, you know, when we think about it, Peter, you know, and when we talk to the youngins about this today, we're not old men screaming off the hill about how bad rap has gotten. We don't like everything that's out, but we also are appreciative of a lot of the new artists that come out because they've helped to advance it in a certain level. I think what's going on now in terms of how some people feel the way that they do is, back in the day, you didn't rap if you really, really didn't have the skills. We know it. You've been in an industry, so you've seen the corporate machinations kind of infiltrate the industry in terms of how we're dictating sound, fashion, and direction. We came up in a time, you know, of course, when we were doing a documentary, when the game was still nascent, the music was still kind of, you know, evolving, and there was still a underground element to it that made it exclusive to those that really, really could appreciate the art that was being articulated, because it wasn't for everybody to get. But if you were in the culture, whether you're black, white, Asian, brown, native, whomever, you got it. If you were really into the culture, you got it. And that's what made it unique back then.
Yeah,
you
know, I totally agree.
You know,
but
it definitely was not for wide consumption. I mean, when we think about some of the albums that were released in the 90s, like 36 Chambers, Illmatic, Ready to Die, you know, OC's Time's Up, you know, South Central Cartel and Gaps and Trust. King, help me out here. We have Ready
to Die.
There's
still anniversaries on these albums, man. There's still anniversaries on these albums, man.
Yeah, man. I mean,
Cuban Link.
You know,
we're still doing anniversary shows and festivities off of that.
Yeah. I mean, look, Old Dirty Bastard, Return to the 36 Chambers in 95. I mean, you know, Slick Rick, you know, The Ruler's Back, 1991, you know, Chronic, 1992, Doggy Style, 1993.
Black Moon.
You know, Black Moon, In the States, 1993. Tribe Called Quest, you know,
The
Midnight Marauders.
Yeah.
That came out the same day as Wu-Tang, as a matter of fact. Geniuses, Liquid Swords, 1995. I mean,
two historical days. That, you know what, there's two historical days right there. That day and the Wu-Tang and Tribe drop, and September 29th, where you had like five albums drop. I think it was Lauryn Hill dropped that day, Jay-Z dropped that day, Outkast dropped that day, I think Badass dropped that day, and I think Black Star, Tribe, it was like six releases that one day.
That was in 1998, as a matter of fact. It was 1998, yeah.
I know, because I bought all of them. And went broke.
It's okay.
I was broke for a month.
Look, by hook or by crook, we got our hands on it. When you look at how music was marketed back then, Peter, because we want to get into your other project too, you know, that you got coming about the billboards of the Sunset Strip with all the rock bands. Before we get into that, tell us about how you see hip-hop being marketed now from a perspective of where it's like, what's going on in terms of what you've seen in terms of how artists get signed and how they're actually being able to put out music?
Well, you know, it's a lot different. I mean, back then, you know, you had to have the big record company. You had to, you know, but they allowed you to have your thing. Now, you know, the bigger record companies, if you are going to get signed, they almost insist on this thing called a 360 deal. Are you guys familiar with that?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. They want everything. They want a piece of everything that you do.
Everything that you do. I mean, because the music ain't enough anymore. I mean, they're not making enough on the music. So, you know, I'll just say this quick story. So, Soulja Boy, I was asked to do a documentary about him. And at the time, he had this beef with, actually it was Ice-T. I don't know if you guys remember that thing. You know?
We remember it.
And,
yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of going back and forth and all that. But, when his management and the company that I was working with, you know, suggested I do it, you know, I honestly wasn't like a huge Soulja Boy fan in terms of the music and whatever, but I was a huge fan of his hustle. And the idea at 16 to produce, record, he did the kinds of things that artists dream about doing, like having his own record company, producing it himself, recording it himself, being the artist. People dream of doing this. So that's why I signed up for the project. And the minute I did, and I talked to his manager, I said, you know, I'm really thrilled to be talking to a guy who at 16 has done what every artist dreams of doing after doing 10 albums, like finally getting control of their own career and being like the kind of guy that could look at the destiny of my own thing. I don't have to depend on a record company anymore. I don't have to depend on this one and that one. And the manager said, oh, God, well, he just signed a 360 deal with Interscope or whatever. And I was like, oh, no, you got to be kidding me. So, like, he felt to be kind of authorized by the industry. He had to be with a big record company. He didn't realize that he had done it all himself and was in a better position to be his own, you know, best advocate, you know? I mean, I was shocked that he did that. You know, I mean, you know, I, at that point I was committed to making the film. I don't know if I would have made the film if I knew that ahead of time, you know?
Well, that's understandable. That's understandable.
Yeah, because as I say, like, I love the idea that this guy went against the system and decided, hey, man, he didn't even have a choice. It wasn't like there were record companies that were looking for him. It was like, you know, he did it himself. He understood social media. He understood how to make it work. But there was still something missing. Like, he felt like, oh, God, I've got to be with a record company. And, you know, I would say to any artist out there, hey, man, if you can do it on your own, you are so much better off.
You know, one thing about it, Peter, we're disclaimer, we're not, you know, trying to talk bad about Soulja Boy. you know, his music isn't our type of music. It wasn't when he first started. But we always respected him because the fact was, like you said, he got out there and did it. You know, at 16, he was out there, you know, in Mississippi and all in the down south doing his own shows, getting money. Now, to give this context, you got to remember, his first record came out in 2006, his first album. So, at the time, social media, of course, MySpace is the thing with which he was really doing it. You know, Black Planet, which was the original, you know, social media. Facebook has still not gone to the level it had gone to yet. Facebook was still a couple years old, and I don't believe had been made public yet. Twitter and Instagram and, you know, were not even thought of, you know, and it was still the elements of, we still didn't see the level of downloading music and direct to consumer, marketing, like actually, you know, selling yourself out on, you know, you know, out there like that. Now, we did have the download sites like LimeWire. If you wanted to contaminate your computer, you could go to LimeWire. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But one thing about it, through all the hijinks, crazy antics and everything, you know, Soulja Boy really trailblazed the way. And I think for that, he does deserve credit. I think it was easy to take advantage of, not to take advantage, what am I thinking? It was easy to criticize him and take shots at him because of the fact that his music was not aesthetically pleasing to where it was for the hardcore audience. But when we look at where hip-hop was in that snap rap era, you know, and also the trap rap era, the 2005 and 2006 era, we got to think about two of the biggest artists that came out during that time, Jeezy and Gucci, who were carrying on the trap rap that T.I. had given the name to. And like my brother said, you know, whatchamacallit, back in the day, Ghetto Mafia. You know, they started
Ghetto Mafia
really in earnest, yeah, 1997, 1996. So You're still in the snap rap. You're talking about D for Real. You're talking about the Franchise Boys, you know, the Shop Boys. You're talking about Crime Mob. All of these artists. I mean, even with Jim Jones, albeit not snap rap, with, you know, his album, PMMB, Product of My Environment, with Ballin. You know, or was that Diary, or was that Harlem Diary of the Summer? What song was Ballin' off of, King? Was that Part of My Environment or Harlem Diary of a Summer? But either way, 2006, I believe 2006 was when Ballin' dropped. So it was a unique time in hip-hop of a new sound. What was it like to film Soulja Boy during that time, Peter, in terms of just watching him do what he did on a regular day-to-day?
Right. Well, you know, that film kind of gives me a good idea of his upswing from, like, being nowhere. Like, I'll tell you this, man. Anybody can make it. Anybody can make it from anywhere. If Soulja Boy could do it, dude, it shows you anybody could do it. I mean, it's unbelievable. Like, you know, he didn't really have any, you know, he didn't have a mom and dad in the business. He lived thousands of miles away from any record company, and for him to pull off what he did was pretty remarkable. You know, and spending time around him, you know, he's a super nice guy. I mean, here's another interesting thing. I mean, you know, even though this was like an authorized documentary and I'm working with him, he would never sit down for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't, and I really needed that. And explaining to the manager, hey, like if you watch the movie, you know, we get quotes from him all the time, but it's not like a real,
It's
not, you know, however, there was so much material that we had gathered, and we actually used like social media stuff, like pop-ups and stuff like that, to present like text and stuff like that to get thoughts and stuff across. So you still get a really deep dive, immersive feel into who this guy is and how he did what he did and what transpired. But I don't know whether, I don't know how, like, from his point of view, saying, hey, I don't want to sit down and do an interview because it's going to be way more interesting if these guys create something unique. And that's what they made us do, which we did. I mean, we had to find a solution to that issue. And as I say, like, we never had, like, you know, just scheduling an interview with him was always impossible. Like, he couldn't do it for some reason, or he canceled for some reason. And, you know, I got upset about it a few times, but You know, the manager said, oh, it's going to happen. And I realized it wasn't going to happen. And I had to finish the film. And I go, oh, God, I've got to find another creative way to tell the story. If you watch that movie, you know, we definitely deliver on what we needed to do, but we kind of did it in a different way, if that makes any sense.
Understood.
You know,
and that,
yeah,
makes you,
yeah,
that's what makes you the consummate professional. Because
yeah,
even
yeah,
with that type,
look,
of, yeah.
You know, when you're given a project, some films, you know, you have deadlines, some films you have air dates, and you have all kinds of different things. I mean, I've always tried to get the film done when it's ready. And that's always a struggle, I can tell you. I mean, particularly when you're doing documentaries. You know, like I'll tell you on Beat, for instance, no one knew who 50 Cent was, if you could believe this, right, when I started doing Beat. And I insisted on having him in the film. Like, at the point, his record came out, I think, after Beef dropped. I might be wrong about that. You know, because, you know, when you deliver the movie, it takes another 8 months or 9 months for it to come out. So they have to do all the QC. They have to do the deliverables. They have to, you know, get it placed. They have to pitch it to the stores. There's a whole process. The record could have come out, but I can tell you, he had a big buzz in the hip-hop world, but not in the mainstream world. So my distributor was going, hey, deliver the movie. We need the – you said you were going to deliver the movie, but I kept, you know, holding him off going, hey, there's this guy named 50 Cent, and I'm telling you, he's going to be the biggest guy in the game. And they were like – they were laughing at me. A guy named 50 Cent, are you kidding me? You know? So, you know, we waited. I mean, fortunately, because of how well Doug Angel did, they gave me more time. And, you know, they never doubted me after that. But, you know, it was a struggle, man. It was, you know, it's always a push it because, you know, they wanted to go through the system. They wanted to make money. They, you know, they want their quarter to be good, you know.
And yet it's still, sure, Peter, you got the last laugh because you saw something with 50 that, shout of course to DJ Wu Kid and Sha Money XL, who were one of the first to help, who were really the first guys to help 50 out. And of course, Jam Master Jay. We cannot rest in peace. We cannot leave out Jam Master Jay because Jam Master Jay was, he was the guy who really believed in 50 before everybody heard of him. Sha Money XL, yeah, and DJ Wu Kid will come later on in terms of health care rating.
That was in the trenches with him. And
yeah.
Those blue guys was in the trenches.
Yeah.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, but I mean, but you think about it, when 50's first mixtape hit in fall of 2002, 50 Cent is the Future, and I got it. I mean, I was blown away. I mean, we had heard him on How to Rob.
I know.
And that was just hilarious on the N2D soundtrack, and this is in 1999, that dropped. So he's still carrying the momentum from that 3 years later into his mixtape, which he would parlay into a record deal, and his album would drop in April 2003. You know, so it's like, I mean, you know, this is a dude who went from having a song on the soundtrack to beefing with Ja Rule, signed to Columbia Records, getting shot, you know, getting dropped from his label, being at home recovering, getting back up to get it again, and then now this guy's an actor, producer, multimedia mogul, one of the most successful businessmen ever in the history of the culture. Pete, we're gonna have to get you. We're gonna have to tap you for some lottery numbers because you got a sixth sense of finding out who these people are gonna be big before everybody else does.
Well, look, man. All you gotta, you know, if you listen to the buzz on the street, you know,
right,
it ain't that hard. You know,
right.
anybody in hip-hop knew he was going to be huge. Anybody, you know, like, but, you know, these executives at these companies, they don't know. I mean, you know, they're not spending any time, you know, analyzing the culture or working in the, in that, in the, you know, in that part of the industry. So, you know, we just, I mean, the buzz on 50 was enormous.
Yep.
And that, you know, took a long time was like just connecting with him and scheduling something with him. You know, thank God. I think we shot him when he was out in Arizona. And what a show. I mean, he put on the show. I mean, I think it was a week before his album dropped. I think that, yeah, something like that. I don't know. He was on tour doing something, but, you know, it was like a club tour.
Mm-hmm. And that's always.
And I can tell even when you shot him, because you know you got some memorable shots of 50 on that DVD where he just said, "I don't like that guy. I don't like Ja Rule at all." He had a little sad look about him.
Yeah.
Tell us about that whole beef series, Pete, because you were the first to chronicle rap beef in terms of rivalry before anybody else. And
before the Blast.
Some of those and some of those conflicts were pretty intense in terms of when we look at what happened with Ice Cube, with him and Cam when they, you know, and they had their little issue, you know, when we look at True Life and Mobb Deep when they had their problems. I mean,
we
covered all of this. Yeah, and dude, you got this for three of them. You were a brave man, and you survived it. you were just a reporter,
go ahead. There were times of tough spots, I'll tell you that. Again, I think the artists trust me, and I was very clear about my intention. And
right.
Look, I'm not here as your friend. I'm here as a journalist. I'm here to get this story, and you know, I'm going to find the truth of the story, and that's what we really try to do. I mean, when you're making a film, you know, there's things you have to do within, like, the parameters of time and everything else. But, thank God, I didn't have one artist who ever came back and said, you know, you really took me out of context, or that really wasn't the way it went down, or, I did have one artist, I can't remember, and I think it was Royce the 5'9", who said, you know what? I don't like the way I look, but I realize that is the way I look, and I got to change. You know, and I thought that was pretty powerful. Man. I mean, look, the same thing with True Life, man. I mean, when we shot that stuff, you know, and he's cracking on, you know, Mobb Deep and blowing off shots and, you know, that was in New York City. On the east side on the
that was Lower East Side. Lower East Side. Manhattan.
Lower East Side.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not in Red Hook or someplace, man. I thought I was crazy. You know?
On the basketball court,
served by the footage, you know, we actually had him. I don't know if it's in the film. We bring him back and, you know, we have watched that clip and get his reaction about it, you know?
And there's one part of that series I will never forget is that look on his face when he's watching it. And it's like all those thoughts are going through his mind in terms of like, man, you know, I really did that and not in a good way. He's like, you know, I got to think about it. I got to make a change. That's not the man that I want to be. That's not the man that I am. But, you know, when he told the story about what happened, about how him and Mobb Deep ended up having that conflict, he was animated about it. And understandably, he was upset about what he feels was basically he got sold up the river for basically, I mean, this is all, you know, this is all on the DVD, y'all. So it's not like
yeah,
we're
all
just talking to talk. But his thing was he felt like that verse, Prodigy used the verse that he had already used for something else. And, you know, he felt like Prodigy hoodwinked him on it. And obviously
yeah.
there were some issues. And obviously, you know, the situation when Infamous Mob gets ran up on. You know, and
yeah,
because we you know, this is before. Go ahead, King. Go ahead.
Yeah. It goes down. Yeah, it went down like that. And plus, what was great about that, what you did for him, because I think being that when a guy on the level of True Life or artists of that, they really feel they don't really have an outlet to get their voices heard, because there's a lot of politics in this thing. So you airing his story gave him a good look, because he couldn't go to Hot 97 and say that. He couldn't go to none of these radio shows because they have clicks. They have partnerships. They have people they're trying to protect.
Right. Yeah. And when you get out there like that too, you know, what you were documenting this before social media. So this is when DVDs like yours were the phenomenon, because you were giving us the uncut truth of what was going on in the industry with a lot of this. You know, this is, you know, before Shade Room, this is before all of these outlets. So, you know, you really had to go there and watch it and hear it from the artists themselves, and that's what made it genuine. There ain't no chance for no type of misunderstanding or misinterpretation, because you're hearing it directly from the artists themselves what went down. Like when Ice Cube talked about the situation, what happened with NWA, and that kind of gave us, because you got to think about it, when Ice Cube left NWA, this was around 1989, 1990. So we knew he left back in the day, but if you were not in the industry, you really didn't understand what happened. But when I watched it, I was like, okay, when Q talked about how he was the only one that never signed a contract because he had saw the money wasn't right, and that's why he ended up leaving. Of course, this was reiterated in the movie as well.
Yeah.
You know, when that was talked about, when, you know, of course, when the characters are talking about what's going on at the, you know, Q's character, you know, shout out to, you know, Q Jr. talking about, you know, why, you know, he's like, yo, you know, what's up with his money here? He's like, and he's like, Jerry, you know, we don't understand. You know, we don't understand what this, you know, I can't understand all this. None of us do. And that's really gave the creep, you know, the clarity on it.
I once confronted Jerry about it. You know, I knew Jerry. And I said to him, you know, it's amazing, because the guy was, you know, there was a lot of good and there was a lot of bad about Jerry. And I think, you know, Jerry felt like the world revolved around him, you know, a little bit, you know. But I said to him one day, I said, Jerry, you know, the group, you know, their issue with you was that you... He goes, yeah, well, that's right. I said, how do you even justify that as being proper, since you're their manager? He goes, well, I never told them to have five guys in the group. So if you look at it financially, they were getting 20% each, and then he got 25. He actually got a bigger share for being the manager. He got 25% of the group, right?
Mm.
And which isn't really, I mean, that's a little on the high side, but, you know, look, Elvis's manager got 50. So, you know, 25, you know, to me, that's on the high side. But, you know, but you got to consider, okay, what are the guys in the group making? And if you're the manager, I think you got to say, I can't make more than the artists I'm representing.
Right.
And he did not get that. He did not understand that. I mean, I said, Jerry, they're the guys that, you know, you don't have a job without them. And, you know, we, you know, he was a tough guy, man. I tell you, he was, you know, played by Paul Giamatti, I believe, in the movie.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah. And Paul did, you know, he's a fantastic actor. And for the most part, he had the character kind of right. But Jerry was like 6'2 or 6'3. He was a big guy.
I didn't know he was that tall.
Yeah, Jerry's a tall guy.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, no, he was a big dude. He was a big dude. He was, you know, he wasn't like a little guy, you know, like a little Napoleonic kind of guy like Paul Giamatti played him. He was like a big guy, you know, and he had a temper, man, you know, like, you know, he'd yell and scream and whatever. But, you know, he was very passionate about his group, but he was also passionate about making money, you know? And, you know, I don't think, like, you know, people say, oh, Jerry was dishonest and he was dishonest with the money. I don't think he was, honestly. I think he would tell you he's making more than them. He wasn't hiding the fact. He wasn't like, oh, no, they're making, you know, expenses, and when you adjust for, you know, growth and all that. No, he said front and center, hey, man, they have five guys in the group. They're getting 20% of you know, their take each, and I get 25 of the band's manager. I was like, well, okay, then that means they're making more than they are, you know. He goes, yeah, that's right. I was like, wow, really? Are you admitting that?
That's very rare, man, because they don't let this. Yeah, because they usually play the mental gymnastics with the masses. They'll tell you, oh, I'm not making that much. You got to ask that person. It's very rare to get somebody
exactly.
like Jerry to tell you what it is.
Yeah, I mean, Jerry, you know, he was very transparent in that kind of way, man. I mean, you know, so, I mean, I think that towards the end of the film, you know, I don't know enough about the business dealings of that group of, like, really what went down. But, you know, I know that Easy was his guy, you know. I mean, you know, whether it's true or not or whether it really happened or not is another story. But Jerry did tell me, like, when it came to some of the other guys in the band that there were issues with, like, he goes, hey, he said he went to Easy and said, hey, man, we got to keep Dr. Dre. I mean, the guy is too incredible. We've got to keep him. Easy was like, oh, we don't need him, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, whatever. I mean, who would say whether that happened or not? But, you know, Jerry was very, you know, I was really surprised when he told me, hey, man, I'm making more than they make. I was like, wow. Another thing
go ahead,
Jerry
go ahead,
told
go ahead.
Me, I don't – I don't know if you guys ever read his book, but he told me this story, and it might be in the book, it may not be in the book, but, you know, he had, you know, and it's in the film that Suge Knight is, you know, working security for NWA, and he told me, and this is when I was making, this is years ago he told me this story, he said, you know, I always said to the guys working for me, if I'm not around, hey, you know, hang out at my desk or use anything I have, you know, until I get to the office, don't worry, you know, make yourself at home. And he said one day he came in and he said, you know, Shug was always this guy with big smiles on his face and kind of happy-go-lucky kind of guy. And he said, I came in one day and Shug was sitting behind my desk.
Whoa.
And I just saw and he
Whoa.
Was looking at, and he was looking at the things on the desk, and I could tell he was picturing himself sitting behind this desk, imagining that he was the guy in charge. And then he caught me looking at him, and he changed back into that other persona, the happy-go-lucky. But he goes, from that moment on, I knew we had to watch out for that guy. Yeah.
I mean, you know, but when you think about the stories that time, you know, because me and Key, oh, God, we spend countless hours talking about the Death Row stories, and we know a lot of people, you know, shout out to Kenya, you know, Hustle, Doug, you know, so many people who we know were with them during that time. And we talk about, we talk about it like, dude, it would have been, oh, my God, if social media had been around back then with those guys.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God, yeah. Every day somebody gets slapped up and going viral.
Yeah. Ooh, boy.
Get slapped on the Instagram Live.
Man, I mean, could you imagine? I mean, shout out to Kelvin Anderson of VIP Records at Long Beach when we had him on a couple years ago. Love him dearly. And he told us about when he was at the golf course that day that the fight broke out between Death Row and all the dudes. what was the king of BG Knockout and all them and Death Row? They started, they got it. And, I mean, could you imagine if somebody had gone on Instagram live at that time and videotaped the whole thing?
Well, you know, I think there is videotape of that stuff.
There is videotape of it, right. There is video of it. But, I mean, to really see it live.
I mean, I think we have it in either Beef 1 or Beef 2.
I mean,
golf club. You know,
yeah. But I mean, that was like a snippet of it that got caught. I mean, y'all got some good footage of it. I mean, you figure in today's time, they would have had that thing running for like damn near, look.
Oh,
that
would
have
been
the whole.
That would have been memes on it.
Man.
That would have been YouTube. You know, they're crazy with the Photoshop, man.
Yeah.
They would have been had some stuff.
Yeah.
But dude, when we saw that footage, we were blown away because, I mean, to see that kind of, you know, to see that rumble happen like it did in real time, this is what we got to tell to really get people an understanding of it. Once again, there was not social media in the 90s like that, so you didn't know a lot about these artists in terms of their personal lives. Not like you do now because Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, so many of these artists put their personal life out there. Back in the day, you literally had to be right there or somebody had to catch a video of some shit before you really, like, knew who this person really was. I mean, with some of these artists out here back in the day, for good and for bad, I mean, especially the bad. I know they're glad that social media wasn't around back then. some of the stories we have heard about some of the people in the industry who shall remain nameless. Oh boy, and stuff we know happened.
Right.
People who were there that told us. Oh man, imagine there being some video about that. Oh my goodness.
Man, they would have been a lot of those dudes. I was going to ask you this too, man, about what was your favorite, this is a personal, what was your personal favorite of the Beef series, 1, 2, or 3?
Definitely one, probably, yeah, one. I mean, 2, there's some great things in 2, and, you know, the third one, there was some crazy, some of the craziest stuff went down in the third one, believe it or not.
I believe it.
Yeah, I mean, we got caught in some crazy situations in Beef 3, but, you know, at that point I was Beef Scout, you know, I became a vegetarian.
I mean, but, you know, one thing about it back then, too.
They came out with another one with B4, and I could tell you wasn't involved with it at all.
No, at that point, it was so popular they had to keep going, and I totally understood that, you know, but I just had enough.
I mean, I've said everything I wanted to know. Like, the first one had to do with the relationships and how these things get started, and that it comes from the spirit of hip-hop. I mean, the problem is the spirit of hip-hop is competition. You know, who can graph better? Who can, you know, DJ better? Who can MC better? I mean, it's always been the – I mean, it's a beautiful thing about the culture. Rather than doing something violent, doing something artistic, you know, to prove your whatever, manhood or, you know, who you are as a person. You know, the second one was all about, you know, the financial schemes and how money, you know, when you really look at it, to me, it's a record companies that profited from these things, right? And they wanted more of it. They wanted, you know, when you get into beef with somebody, but the stakes are raised so much higher. You know, before, like when the bridge is over, you know, and things like that, I mean, people weren't making that much money. There weren't that many people under them. Like, even if the artists were cool, you know, when it got to be more money, you know, that artist is now trickling down money to other people, and somebody might want to prove themselves. Somebody might say, hey, man, you know, they're taking money out of my man's pocket. I got to do something about it. You know, whatever. You know, crazy thing, you know? So in a way, you know, when record companies made made rap the focus, and then, you know, these beefs started happening where they were, you know, reaping the rewards or the profits from these record sales, you know, I think we wanted to create that understanding of where that was coming from on the financial level. And then B3, we were probably cashing in. I mean, B3, I think, had more of, you know, like that these beefs weren't just happening in West Coast, you know, East Coast, but were happening all over the country and, you know, the different things that were going on. So, you know, I mean, B3... I mean, there's some good stuff in that film, but, you know, I think I was done by that point.
Yeah, and I could tell by Next Up, you did actually one of my favorite documentaries, too, man. This was Letter to the President. So you got into the politics and the economic side of hip-hop.
Yeah. Now, Letter to the President, I got to give my man, I helped with that movie. I helped, you know, with some of the production things. But that was actually directed by my friend, my very good friend. And if you guys want him for your show, he would be incredible, Thomas Gibson.
Okay.
You will have him.
Yeah,
give him our
really
contact. We'd love to have him on the show.
We'll
call you after the show. We'll set that up. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was very proud of that movie. That is a great film. I mean, I was, I think I was there when they shot the web, you know, the guy that got killed or killed himself. But I think was killed.
Oh yeah,
made that connection between CIA and the running the gun. They ended up making a movie about it. You know, I don't know if you guys have seen the movie. I can't even think of the name of the film. But yeah, the Gary Webb. And you know, we had this incredible interview with Gary Webb where he said, you know, if I'm dead in a month, you know, or 2 months, you know, just remember, you know. I didn't commit suicide. I mean, and shit, then he fucking, you know, like two gunshots to the head. How does that happen? You know?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that whole thing is, to me, is so dirty.
I mean, but this shows your, I mean, Peter, this shows your range, your diversity. I mean, you're an author, a musician, I mean, a director, a producer. I mean, you've gone into places of cinema and documentary pieces that have been as impactful and important as they are diverse and different. I mean,
well, I appreciate it.
Yeah. Go ahead, please.
No. I definitely appreciate the compliment. I mean, I've always tried to do,
or push the envelope, you know, try to create understanding. You know, I work a lot with indigenous nations. You know, I've done 3 films on Native people. You know, so, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm proud of the films I've made.
Tell us about the indigenous pieces that you've done.
Well, the first film I did was called The Walk, which was about it was a spiritual walk from the Palo Reservation in San Diego to Sacramento, and these guys walked 760 miles. And when I was asked to do this film, I thought we would have like months to prepare and everything, but the people that came in to talk to me about it said, hey, they're walking in a week. But their pitch to me was so convincing that I said I had to do it. And without any financing, again, I go running out there, you know, following them. And, you know, film ended up at the Sundance Film Festival. And then in 2017, I did a film called Spirit Game, Pride of a Nation, about the Iroquois people who actually, if you wrap this around your head, there are people mm-hmm. that live here inside America, but they fly on American passports. They fly on their Iroquois Haudenosaunee passport. So when they're traveling to other countries, they're not using an American passport, which is how it should be. I mean, they have treaties with America where they have their own identity and their own nationhood.
Mm-hmm.
And they hosted all of these nations on their territory. One of the proudest things I have going, making that film, was in the early stages of development when they were like, okay, so these countries fly into America and then they're going to drive onto our nation. I suggested them setting up an immigration center so that the nations had to get their passport stamped. And incredibly, even America got their passport stamped going to the Onondaga Nation for this big tournament. And the only nation that wouldn't do it out of the 15 nations, I mean, you had nations like, you know, England, you know, Ireland, you know, Japan, you know, all these nations from around the world. The only one that wouldn't do it was Canada, believe it or not. If you don't know, Canada is actually worse on Native people than America is.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, people don't know that.
But, I mean, but I tell you. Go ahead.
No, most people think Canada would be, you know, kinder to Native people, but they've made it actually much more difficult for them. And as bad as it is here, it's actually worse in Canada.
I mean, when you think about, you know, in terms of the American, the indigenous here, and the atrocities they suffered, you know, being the first to be the subject of chemical warfare with the blankets
sure.
infested with smallpox, the long forced march, the Trail of Tears. Shout out to the band Testament from their 1994 release, Low, with the song Trail of Tears. Oh, my God. Chuck Billy, Alex, you know, Greg Peterson, of course, James Murphy on guitar. Greg Christian, I believe, damn, I'm trying to think of who was on drums at the time. It wasn't Louis Clemente. Damn, and I'm forgetting because it was a dude who used to drum for Forbidden, and it wasn't John. Oh, man. But, yeah, I was just running off a random trivia. But, oh, my God, that song is so powerful, Trail of Tears. For those who have not heard that album or at least that song, go listen. But, you know, in terms of what the Native people have dealt with here, I mean, there was that documentary talking about how a lot of these Native women go missing. I think they said over 10,000 Native women go missing a year, and, like, they're never looked for or nothing. You know?
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but, yeah,
Yeah. I mean, the residents of Golden Canada were much worse. You know, they've had they wiped out a lot of their food sources, so they a lot of them starved to death. I mean, it's just unbelievable stuff. But you know, America has plenty to be ashamed for.
Yeah, you know, one thing about it is, this is the one thing people have to understand. We speak on the atrocities that happen in America. It's not because we hate this country, you know, but it's like we want this country to acknowledge what has happened. And that's when we get into these dangerous places where people want to try to ban books and not acknowledge it and speak on the history. I'm like, you know, one of the things...
Revisited history.
Yeah, and I will never forget this quotation from Dwight Eisenhower. When they got to the, I believe it was Auschwitz, one of the concentration camps of the Holocaust. And when he saw, when they broke through and they stormed the gates and saw what was going on, he said, you know, get somebody out here. He's like, get somebody and make sure they got a camera. He's like, get somebody with a camera out here now, because in about 50 years, some damn idiot is going to try to say that this never happened.
Oh, I know. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, we have to, in order for us to move on, we have to acknowledge, you know, the atrocities and things that we have here. There was a, you know, what's unrecognized, you know, we all recognize the Jewish genocide. Very few Americans recognize the Native American genocide. There were between 15 and 20 million Native people living here before, you know, this place was invaded. And then, you know, within a few hundred years, there's less than, you know, a few hundred thousand.
Yeah.
Where did those 15 people go?
Yeah. And I mean, but that's something that we have to, and then, you know, from everything that has happened, you know, in terms of, you know, one thing about it with this country is that there's always tried to be a picture of a high moral ground and a view of what is considered being racially, you know, pragmatic. And it hasn't always been like that. You know, and that's something that, it hasn't always been easy. I mean, when you look at it, you think of the Civil Rights Bill was passed in 1964, that ensured civil rights for, you know, especially black people. You have to think about how long we've been at war in this country. I believe, this country's been around, 250-some years, and we've been at war for, 220 of it is some type of conflict, is some type of armed conflict we've been involved with. We've been involved in for a majority of that. And at least this is what is important about what you do in hip hop and in a broader scale of social commentary, Peter, because one thing about it is this. One cannot underestimate or disavow or dismiss what has happened in the world. And if people like yourself are not brave, bold, and courageous enough to tackle the truth and hold it down and then hold it up for everybody to see it, you're going to have some asshole pseudo-academics trying to rewrite it and say, well, this didn't happen or this is a conspiracy. King knows how I am about this, so I'm not going to talk too much about it because I'm going to get fired up about it because there is
this is the space we live in today where people can just make up stuff out of thin air and go viral.
Exactly.
I know. And I'm sure you guys have friends that are, you know, get hooked into that stuff. I mean, I have friends that send me stuff, and I'm like, you know, as a journalist or somebody who, you know, feels like, you know, there's, you know, accountability, or
you know, when we did these films, we had to check the, you know, even though somebody said something, you know, you still had to check whether it was true or not. But now people just go on. I mean, without any third-party verification or anything, you know, they put out this stuff. People believe it. It's unreal to me.
And then call you crazy. And they call you crazy because you ask questions about the validity of it.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, you know, I mean, people hear things on like Fox or Newsmax or even CNN. I mean, you know, I would say to have a healthy amount of skepticism is probably a good thing, you know. But, you know, I read a variety of news sources and I try to then figure out, you know, what in my world is real, you know. But you got to be careful. Like, you got to realize, like, kind of figure out who's writing it, what agenda do they have. And, you know, with the deregulation of news that Reagan, I blame him for, it's kind of where we're at, you know. There isn't really a lot of transparency or oversight of news organizations anymore, you know. I thought it was very telling when Obama, you know, when they have that presidential press or thing for the press that he didn't have for the lanyards or for the, you know, for the where you're sitting, there's names that are put down in front of whatever organization is supposed to be there. And Fox, he didn't have Fox News, he just had Fox, right? Because they really aren't news. They're more like Fox Entertainment, because you're definitely not getting news from them.
Well, when we look at places like Fox, Breitbart, Newsmax, they all have a narrative that they're trying to push. And when you look at it, if you're in a particular box of thought, then you're going to be pretty much crated in that, you know. And it's just, you're going to take what's delivered to you with that, because there's a common thread of, you know, paranoia, conspiracy, but very little facts. A lot of sizzle, but no steak. And but it's still palatable, because those people are going to choke off the grease baldness of it, you know. But their thing is, They could get a high cholesterol of ignorance, and guess what? They'll think that they're eating love and it's nutrition for them. I'm like, no, it's poison.
Yeah. I mean, you know what we don't recognize, and cause this has been occurring now for the past 8 or 9 years, is that what we did, we had these campaigns of propaganda in foreign countries, right? Misinformation, disinformation, pamphlets, all this stuff that we would indoctrinate countries that we wanted to control or oversee.
Mm-hmm.
And these other countries now have taken what we've done and now using it against us. You know, people just don't understand that. I mean, they're using the same that we pioneered and created against these other countries. Now it's being used against us, and we don't even know it.
But what we've seen now, though, Peter, is a lot of the prominence of ignorance that has come in this country with people who have risen to public office. I mean, we got a reality show guy who got into the office. We have a governor of Florida who's trying to ban books. You know, we have a guy in Texas who went on vacation while his people were freezing. You know, I mean, senator who went, you know what I'm saying? So we've seen this blatant perversion of the, because the freedom of speech is one of the most sacred freedoms in this country to repossess. The problem is some people take that and they pervert it in ways of spreading lies and misinformation. And when you have people who have already felt disenfranchised or outright disillusioned with government, they're prone to believe it. I mean, when you look at what happened in World War II, how Hitler came to power, what did he do? He put it all on the Jews and said, these are the people, he started propaganda, said, this is why, you know, we're poor. This is why we all fucked up over here, because of them. He found a target and everybody went for it. And we saw one of the greatest genocides, we saw one of the worst genocides in history in terms of a people who were damn near exterminated. You know, and this is something that if we're not careful, you know, like the Roman Empire fell, we could fall on it. A lot of times when you're looking at how the infrastructure of a nation falls, it's not from a foreign invader. It's from the people inside of it who decided they're smarter or they're more capable than the people who are in leadership. Leadership is a state of mind about what is pragmatic and about what is good to lead the common populace, how everybody benefits, not just one or two people who get to make a choice about what's good for a few others. And we have to understand that. You know,
I totally agree. I mean, I always feel like we're living on the edge of democracy, you know, and that it's very fragile. You know,
it is.
You got to buy in. I mean, you know, I don't know whether any of these rumors are true about Trump, but, you know, he's talking about doing a bunch of things when he gets in immediately. You know, that could be crazy. You know, I mean, I don't know, man. You know, you just have to hope that common sense and reason prevail, you know.
I mean, but that's something that he has his audience and people will believe the ignorance that he spews, you know, and try to say, I don't want to get too deep up here, but it's just you got a lot of people who are, they believe a lot of the nonsense that he says, where the fact is his thing is about what he's going to get for himself. And it's like, don't fool yourself thinking that you're one of his people. If you're not in the same class of people that he associates with in terms of being the privileged elite, you ain't benefiting from nothing with it. You know, that's a snake oil salesman with a tongue that's gonna lay out oil that you're gonna fall all over. You know, you're gonna get smeared in it, and you're gonna think that it's soap and that you're glistening.
I couldn't agree more, man. You have him wrapped up. You know. I mean, look. You know, people ask me, do I think, you know, Trump is a racist, and I think his thing is green. If you've got money, he's going to be your friend. So no matter what color you are, I think he's going to, you know, he's fine with that. You know, it's the people that are, you know, need help, that are marginalized. I mean, those are the people he can care less about, you know. So, you know, he feels like if it's good for him, it's good for the country, you know. And it's kind of the way he operates.
Well, it's about que bono, Pete, who profits. It's Latin for who profits. And it's about how I get something out of it. Damn everybody else, what's in it for me? And I think it's, you know, when we look at it in this country, for all the freedom, and, you know, like I said, I've said this on the show a million times, I'm a devout Democrat, liberal, gun-loving, Second Amendment Republican, because I'm heavy on the guns. I'm heavy on the guns. You're not taking our guns away. But the thing is, and when these people talk about, oh, the government's taking our guns, I'm like, no, they're not. I'm like, that's our constitutional right in the Second Amendment. They're not coming to take our guns. That's the fear tactic that they use to try to get y'all to do. I'm like, nobody. Yeah, exactly. Ain't nobody coming to take nobody's guns.
Fear is the new way of profit now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, sell paranoia. The price of the price of compliance is to fill paranoia, and then ultimately, you know, and that, and people will buy into it if they think there's something near and dear to them. Even if it's not true, they want to believe it, so they have a reason to act up on it. And, you know, for all the freedoms in this country that we enjoy in terms of especially voting, we have one of the least voting turnouts in this in the world. You know, other countries,
yeah,
when they get a chance to vote, they go out and do it. You know, but here,
well, you know,
a lot of
the one thing I'd say about that, though, is that
mm-hmm.
these other countries, they give you the whole day off to vote. I mean, they make
right.
it a really interesting day. Like, you get the day off, you get the, you know, some countries, they even, you know, you're paid that day to, you know, to go to and vote, you know. And I think in this country, we make it kind of, they don't want people to vote because they know most people that would probably vote Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they want it more difficult for those people to get to the voting booths. You know, why not do it on a national holiday? I mean, I don't understand that. I don't know why we don't vote, you know, have a day off to vote, you know, make sure everybody can get to the polls.
And I also tell
people
mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, I mean, I'm saying a lot of people working two jobs, you know, they're struggling. You know, for them to get to vote, it's a real heartache.
It is. And, you know, I tell people, you know, because I'm a registered Democrat, I'll say it on the air, and I tell people, and I want to word this carefully, watch who's trying to tell you at certain levels. You know, you got a lot of people trying to say, well, you know, Democrats haven't worked for us. You know, I'm like, so wait a minute. So we're basically going to go vote for a party with the Republicans that really, I mean, Tim Scott came out and said it today that, you know, he was, you know, from South, you know, I believe from, was it South Carolina, Florida. And he has said that he said the Republicans are not going to get behind a black candidate. Now, mind you, he's a black Republican. and he said they're not going to get behind a black, you know, because he, you know, he ended his presidential campaign. So he knows it. But, and people try to say, oh, and I love this when they try to say, they say, well, you know, the Democrats were for slavery. I'm like, yeah, but you got to think about when it all changed. You know, when they said the Republicans were for, you know, the freedom. And I'm like, you're absolutely right. It all changed in 1960. And really, it started in 1963 when Kennedy, before he was assassinated on November 22nd, that he had introduced the Civil Rights Bill. And a lot of those, a lot of the Democrats in Congress who did not support it turned Republican. Now, Lyndon B. Johnson ultimately would be the one who passed it through. And also, I'm going to go there. He had one of the greatest quotes that I've ever heard. He said, if you can convince the lowest white man that he's better than the average colored man, you know, you can empty out his pockets. Hell, give him someone to look down on and he'll empty out his pockets for you.
Mm.
That's deep.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to understand, you know, the fact is that everybody, all of us here have a struggle that we are, you know, no matter where we come from a walk of life, whether we're black, white, Asian, indigenous, whatever, brown, we all are just trying to survive here. And, you know, we need to look very carefully. I tell anybody, whatever your political affiliation is, whatever your stance is, you have a right to it. That's guaranteed in the Constitution. We are free people in this country. But I also tell people, also be very careful who you make your political alignment, allegiances with. And before you make a choice, make sure it's an educated one, out of fact and not an emotional one, out of, what's the word I'm looking for? Oppositional ignorance, being contrary, simply wanting to be anti because you think that's so revolutionary. Revolution ain't shit unless it's a solution that's for the benefit of everybody. A revolution without a cause is chaos.
Agree. Totally. Totally.
Damn, man, we just got political. We definitely don't want Blog Talk to cut us off. Pete, you know we're going to be in touch with you after the show because we ain't even touch on everything that we wanted to touch on. We're going to get that for part two when you're ready to do it. Shout out to Kathy again. Pete, tell everybody where they can find you and tell everybody again about your Academy Museum screening next week.
Right, right. So, you know, my company's Rugged Entertainment. You know, you can check that out. I do have the Biggie film right now, so you can check that, you know, the Notorious Bigger Than Life, that documentary, which I think is one of the best documentaries about him. But this Monday, day after Thanksgiving, if you're in L.A., come to the Academy Museum, the Academy of Motion Pictures Museum. We have a screening of Rhyme and Reason, which hasn't been screened in 25 years. You know, you've seen it on TV, but to see it on the big screen is really a treat. And I'll be signing my new book called The Book of Rhyme and Reason, photographs based on that movie. So, you know, and the photographs are sensational. The book came out better than I could have ever imagined.
Peter, this has been unbelievably
great show.
Enjoyable. I mean, this is one of the greatest shows we've ever done. We actually have an Oscar nominee on the show. Off the Cuff is just doing it right now.
Well, congrats to you guys. And, you know, thanks for, you know, getting in touch with me and making it happen. I really appreciate it.
We appreciate you. And like you said, get in touch with your mans. We would love to have him on the show. I mean, look, anybody else, you know, shout out to your whole team, you know, at Rugged Entertainment, man. I mean, you know, you know, you all have done so much in terms of just, you know, enriching the culture and just, you know, just bringing it along in a way of just really being curators and caretakers for it. You know what I mean? It's just, you know,
much
I mean, man, yeah.
Cool. Well, you guys have a good one. I really appreciate it. And yeah, definitely, I'd be more than pleased to come back.
Definitely,
man. We yes.
Well, man. We thank you once again for joining us. It was a great build, great history, and we definitely love to have you back on in the near future as well, man. So we definitely appreciate you to join us. We'll be on live tomorrow night, and I'm out.
Peace.
Great. Thank you. Peace.